Welcome to Life's IB. I'm your host, June Wang, and today I'm so excited to share my chat with Dr. James Min, founder and CEO of Clearly Health. Clearly Health is using machine learning algorithms to non-invasively analyze signs of coronary heart disease to improve heart disease diagnosis. Clearly is based on Jim's research that he has been doing for approximately 20 years as a former professor of radiology and medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College and the director of the Dalio Institute of Cardiovascular Imaging at New York Presbyterian. Jim is also a past president of the Society of Cardiovascular Computed Tomography and a leader in the American College of Cardiology. Jim received his BA from the University of Chicago and his medical degree from Temple University Medical School. He completed his internship, residency, and cardiovascular medicine fellowship at the University of Chicago Hospitals. Please join me in welcoming Jim to the show. Jim, thanks for joining us. I wanted to start the conversation at the beginning of your career with our traditional Life's IB starting question, which is, where did you grow up and what did you want to be when you grew up?
I was born in Norman, Oklahoma, so I'm a lifelong Sooners fan. And I was raised in Southeast Wisconsin, so I've been a lifelong Green Bay Packers fan. And I did college and postgraduate medical training all in Chicago, so I've been a lifelong Chicago Bulls fan. And then when I was young, I think I didn't really know exactly what I wanted, but I liked science a lot. And so things around science and sort of, you know, watching knowledge gain and creating new knowledge, I think that was what drove me to do what I'm doing now.
There's a lot within the science field. How did you land in cardiology and imaging?
Yeah, it's interesting. I like the clinical sciences a lot. You know, I think that the world fundamental inventions like in science that describe methodologies, they change the world. Things like polymerase chain reaction or PCR or CRISPR technology, these kinds of things, they're methods, right, that can be applied in so many different ways. I always found myself more interested in applied science or applications of how can you use new technologies to find a use case that directly helps people. So for me, that was how I got into what I'm doing and why I structured it that way, where, you know, we utilize the technological advance, in this case, a non-invasive imaging tool. And then we did a bunch of clinical trials around it to really help understand, you know, its effect on describing a patient's evolution and path through life and whether they'd stay healthy or not. And then figuring out a way to sort of intervene on that in order to try to affect the natural history of that patient's evolution and trajectory in a positive and meaningful way. And the, you know, I like cardiology. You know, for me, coronary heart disease was always an interest of mine. It is the number one public health epidemic in this world. It is the number one killer, the number one cause of morbidity, and the number one cost to the healthcare system. So it seemed like a meaningful topic to try to tackle. It's also something scientifically and intellectually, it's interesting to me. Because of that, I had planned to go into cardiology, but I had planned to do interventional cardiology where, you know, there you put on the lead and you go into the lab and you put in stents and, you know, and things like that. And I switched to non-invasive imaging because I saw an early iteration of a cardiac CT scanner. And this is now dating back to like 2002, 2003. And it was probably one of the few scans in the world that actually you could actually see the heart on this CAT scan. But I recognized that the technology was going to improve. And I thought it was going to fundamentally change our understanding of coronary vascular biology in a way that we could really change the paradigm of how we evaluate and treat and track people over time. So I switched over into imaging to utilize this new tool that was just coming out. The actual heart scanners, CT scanners, commercially came out in 2005. And so It was just timing, to be honest. Had I been a couple years earlier, I'd be doing interventional cardiology. But because of the time of when they were releasing that scanner, I could switch over and then focus on imaging more than interventions.
It's interesting to contrast that experience with the idea of having a well-thought-out career plan. How did you realize when you saw that CT scan for the first time that that was the direction you wanted to go in and veer off perhaps your original career plan?
I mean, I agree with you that it's, you know, there's influences in your life sometimes that are unexpected. A number of them have occurred in my life and they are quite memorable. That was one, just seeing that scan. It was a what was called a four slice CT scanner. It's very non-invasive. It's just like an X-ray essentially. Now we have like, I don't know, 640 slice CT scanners, and the technology's gotten so much better. But it was just so exquisite the way that you could visualize the heart and the heart arteries that I really felt like it was going to be a fundamental frame shift in the field. It, you know, we needed, and I thought that we could learn so much from it. And so that's why it was, we were so focused on doing large scale clinical trials. I always tried to give the advice to the fellows in training that, you know, if it's a scientific question worth asking, it's a scientific question worth asking within the context of a prospective multicenter clinical trial, high quality science. And so we did that for a number of years. And I just sort of thought that people would see the obviousness of it, that I saw that it was really going to help us understand patients' illness in a way that we had never been able to appreciate before. It took us 20 years. In late 2021, the American Heart Association guidelines and the American College of Cardiology guidelines elevated the CT non-invasive scan to a level 1A recommendation over any other tool for patients with stable or acute chest pain. And so it took a while. It's still going to take longer for us to even utilize the value of this scan, and more science needs to be done. But that's just the way it is. Like, I think in contrast to other fields where you can make something and then just release it, here the stakes are too high, right? Like, you can't do something and then just practice on patients because you have lives at risk. And so I think you just have to be very scientifically rooted so that you know that what you're doing for people is good for them.
Before we get any further, let's talk about Clearly. For those in the audience who aren't familiar with the company, could you describe what's the problem you're trying to solve and what's the solution that your team has come up with?
So the problem that we're trying to solve is to eradicate heart attacks from the face of this earth, or at least help support physicians in doing so. And so if you think about it and take a step back at a very macro view, you can ask yourself, like, what is the problem? Because it's still the number one killer in the world. It hasn't gone down for the last, you know, 30 years. It's always been the number one killer. And the problem can either be that we don't have the adequate treatments for these people. Or the problem can be that we don't actually identify the people well enough to intervene in time before their heart attack event occurs. And when I talk about intervention, I don't mean some surgery or anything like that. I'm talking about lifestyle changes and, you know, non-invasive medical therapy with generic medications. And so what occurred to me when I looked at all of the toolbox that we have of medications, if you do a sort of a simple additive risk reduction of all of them, it comes up to like 96% or 93%. And so we have the tools today to eradicate heart attacks and strokes from the face of this earth. The problem isn't in the treatment options, the problem is in the identification. And so what was taught to me when I was training as a fellow 20 years ago was it's the symptomatic patient who is at risk of a heart attack. And if you can relieve the symptoms, you can reduce the risk of heart attack. It turns out that was totally wrong. We now have like at least seven large-scale randomized controlled trials that shows that symptomatic patients are at risk, but intervening on them with some sort of stent or things like that actually just relieves the symptoms, but it doesn't do anything to the risk of heart attack events going forward. So what we really needed to understand was like, okay, then how do we? I think we were conflating two questions. The, hey, I have chest pain or shortness of breath, the symptom question, with, hey, I'm at elevated risk of a heart attack. Those are two questions, not one. So we try as a company to tackle the second one, is how do we identify people at risk? So when you look back and you say, well, how many people are symptomatic before their heart attack event occurs? It turns out more than half of them have no symptoms, and then one day they have a heart attack, or one day they die, have sudden coronary death. And I think we all know somebody like that, right? Who went for a run and never came back, or went to sleep and never woke up. And, you know, tragically, that's the majority of people who are diagnosed with heart disease are diagnosed by either dying or suffering a heart attack event. So what our company does is it leverages this non-invasive imaging tool to really extract every single piece of actionable information to help support doctors in knowing exactly what's going on in their patients' arteries so that they know exactly how to treat those patients. And then they can track those patients quantitatively over time, non-invasively, to prove that their therapies are actually working to stabilize the disease, to prevent new disease formation, and then hopefully to eradicate heart attacks from the face of the earth. This came out of a clinical program that we had done when I was working as a cardiologist at Cornell Medical College and New York Presbyterian Hospital on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. We had a prevention program where we did exactly what we're doing at Clearly. We just did it very manually. And so we had a lot of people working many hours per patient to analyze images and really provide this exquisite phenotypic information about disease in a manner that could help support our decision making to try to prescribe either lifestyle or medical therapy in a way that would prevent heart attacks and improve their lives. And so we knew it worked. We had a very successful program for 7, 8 years, but it just wouldn't scale because we couldn't. It was so manual and time intensive. It was taking us, you know, upwards of 8, 10 hours to analyze these images per patient, and we just needed a way to automate the whole thing. So what we did was we utilized the non-invasive CT scan, and then we created a number, an array of these sort of AI-enabled algorithms to try to automate this whole thing that we were doing manually. And what we found was that the AI could also decipher things that a human, no matter how long they had, could never figure out. And so we helped to try to do that in a way that could be applicable to any health system across the world. And so when we started the company, we never tried to be an AI company or an imaging company. What we really wanted to do was create what we call a digital care management platform. So a standardized, a comprehensive, and most importantly, a personalized assessment of heart disease evaluation, education, supporting the doctors in treatment decision making, and then also quantitative tracking so that you know whether or not things are working or not. And so that pathway really serves to try to help educate all of the stakeholders across the care pathway, no matter who you are, a general cardiologist, a radiologist, a preventive cardiologist, an interventional cardiologist, researchers, but most importantly, the patients. Because how many times have you gone to the doctor? They give you a report, you look at it, and you're like, I don't understand this at all. And what I realized is that we do a very poor job as a field educating patients. And then we ask, well, why aren't they compliant with the therapies that we're giving them? It's because we've never taken the time to actually explain it to them. So our technology auto outputs materials for patients that anybody can understand and be empowered by the data that we've gotten from this exquisite analysis of somebody's heart. And the exquisite analysis of somebody's heart can come through all of these technological advances, all of these machine learned algorithms that we've trained and validated over time.
What's fascinating about your vision for Clearly is that it didn't start with the product, but rather the questions, which you studied through your research. So how did you turn your research into a product and eventually a company?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Like the, you know, there's a quote that I often use as the first slide on a lot of the lectures that I give, but it's a quote by Albert Einstein. And he said, you know, if I had 60 minutes to solve a problem, and my life depended on it, I'd use the first 55 minutes, determining the proper question to ask. And I think that that's what, so for us, the product was sort of natural because all of the questions that we were asking were all in these large scale clinical trials that we had done to ask questions about vascular biology. So when we started, we thought that all atherosclerosis or plaque buildup in the arteries was bad. And we thought it was just sort of one disease. It turns out there's many different types of plaque buildup in the arteries, and some of them are actually protective, and some of them are very pathologic. And so we didn't know that. That came out of the trials that we're doing. So as we learned, we started to then say, okay, well, if there's certain plaques that are very high risk in the research studies, can you alter those plaques and in a way that can help stabilize them? So we did another clinical trial in patients who underwent serial imaging and try to see the effects of good medical therapy and what that does to plaque and whether or not that change on the plaque can actually help to, reduce heart attacks. As we are learning all of these things, I could go on for hours about the findings that we learned, but then we started to apply it in our clinical prevention program because we knew it to be true. Like some of the trials were, the smallest ones were probably around 500, but the largest trials we were doing were 20, 30,000 people with 5-year outcomes. And so we knew that it was truth that we were seeing because the truth came in the numbers and the statistical robustness of what we were doing. And then we saw it in real life, in practice, when we were taking care of patients, when we applied these lessons that we learned from the trials into our clinical program at Cornell, it worked. And so then we said, okay, great. Like now we know the questions that were important. We know how to apply it in clinical practice. We just don't have standardized care management platform that can allow all practitioners to deliver the care in this way. And that was the nidus of clearly. Now, mind you, I never planned to jump out of academic medicine. I had an amazing job at Cornell and New York Presbyterian, but we had a very generous donor who helped to support our personnel. So we could take 8, 10 hours to analyze these images. And after a few years into our work, like, he just asked the question. I don't even know if he would remember, but he's like, so when does this stuff get to humans? And I was thinking, well, it never gets to humans. We're academic physicians, like we're physician scientists. We write papers, we take care of patients, we give podium talks, but it never becomes a product. And, sort of the collective look on the room's face was like, what are we doing all of this work for if we can't apply it at scale and really deliver this best-in-class care to the world? And so I had had a small startup that we sold in 2016. It was sort of a bootstrapped startup. And so in 2017 said, you know what, let's do this because like it's worth doing. Like we have a very successful clinical program that can effectively prevent heart attacks at Cornell and New York Presbyterian. Let's figure out a way to create the tools to be able to give to the practitioners so that they can do it anywhere in the world. And that was the nidus of clearly and why we formed the company.
We spoke a lot about the hypotheses that generated a positive or interesting insight. Are there any instances of when some clearly research was disproven?
Yeah, there were definitely ones. I can remember one paper that we published in the Journal of American Heart Association, and we had a fellow at that time, and he came up to me and he said, Jim, I've been working on this analysis for 6 months, and I just cannot make it positive. No matter what I do, it doesn't turn like a positive result. And I looked at him, I said, well, then publish it as a negative result. That's knowledge too, right? Like that something doesn't work is just as important as that something does work. I think in medical science and publications, the top line headlines are always around the positive results, right? Like and then the more positive they are, the more press that they get. But I think that what the more important thing is to seek truth, right? If you can seek truth, then you're always better equipped to handle, and take care of patients. If you don't seek truth and you always have a bias towards what you think is must be intrinsically right, then you'll be blinded to a lot of the good things that we can do for people, as well as the bad things that may harm people. And so it was that Journal of American Heart Association paper that was most illustrative of that. But I mean, we ask a lot of questions. We're wrong a lot. And that's okay. Like, we always ask it within the context of a research study, but only when we do understand that something works, that something's good for humans, did we then translate it into our clinical program. I think right now we sit on, clearly as a company, we sit on at least 2 dozen multicenter large scale trials, all conducted over the last 20 years, two decades, resulting in more than 1,000 peer-reviewed publications. So we know, I mean, to the best that we can do, I think this we now have that understanding of vascular biology that can help us support physicians to take better care of patients. And it is truly evidence-based, and we aren't stopping. I mean, we still have several multi-center trials that are ongoing because the products came out of the science, and then the product innovation will come out of new science. And so we'll always stand.
Speaking of new products, what is your team's process for developing new products?
Yeah, that's also a really good question. So we have a product roadmap that extends at least 10 years. So we know what we're going to make. Probably at some point we'll modify that roadmap because we will learn new things and adapt and pivot accordingly. But I'll tell you that the products that we're making, they answer a question, and those questions always came from the patients. So, you know, I always told our trainees that the best scientific questions that you're going to ask in medicine will come from the patients, because the patient will ask you something or present a certain way, and you'll say, huh, I don't actually know the answer of what we should be doing here, because that answer doesn't exist in the world. And then you ask that scientific question, you test it in a study so that you can understand better, you know, what the answer to that question is. Once you have that answer, the clinical answer, then the product's roadmap becomes pretty clear. Like because you're always doing something to try to serve the patients and the physicians. So I think that's how we've done product development. And, you know, I think that contrasts to some other companies who maybe make a product and then try to figure out what we can use it for. Instead, we figured out the use and then recognized that we didn't have a near automated approach to doing that, and we needed to make a product to do so.
Your product development roadmap is also agile, which is different from other med tech processes. How does your team build in that flexibility while also having a 10-year roadmap?
Yeah, it's a great question, actually. And it's been posed internally to me by a number of our my colleagues. And, you know, when CT, non-invasive CT came out, like, we thought this would be better than the current standard of care. And we did all the research to try to either prove or disprove that. Somehow we proved it. And so that's great. Now we know we have a better tool. So one question that I've gotten a number of times from my colleagues is like, what if something new comes out and it's better than what we're doing? And I said, well, that's okay. Then we'll stop doing what we're doing and we'll go to using what's better. And they said, but what if that requires a radical shift? And I said, well, that's okay. Then we'll radically shift. And they said, but why? And they said, because we're truth seekers. And I'm not going to hawk a product that doesn't work. And so what we'll do is we will make the right thing that helps people. And then we'll never have to worry. So, I mean, you asked me a little bit about what got me into medicine. To this day, I think of myself as scientist first, doctor second, and business person third. And to me, what a scientist does is seek truth. And then what a doctor does is a caretaker. And I think what a business person is a value creator. And so I think that truth seeking, caretaking, value creation, all of those are going to be required to make a successful company. But I always seek truth first. And that's why you can pivot anytime, because if you've proven yourself wrong, then better to do something that's right. Because, yeah, you can probably, some companies can sell something that's wrong for a while, but in the end, the truth comes out. And so I think, and that is validation by science, right? Because if you're doing something that's truly evidence-based, then you don't have to worry because you know that you're on the right side of truth.
It sounds like part of that agility is building in the right culture. Again, ask those right questions when that time comes of whether or not you're creating the right product for.
I think so. And then I don't think you have to worry so much about product market fit, right? Because you already fit the market. Like, so now you're creating a product, and that product then can scale, which is great, but you already know the fit is there. You just have to now create the product. So in some ways it makes it much easier than trying to make a product and then wondering if you can create product market fit, which sometimes you cannot. It's better that the use case and the need is already there, and now you're going to create a product that allows that to scale.
Speaking about adapting to new technology, how is Clearly thinking about adopting generative AI? Are there applications of Gen AI you're excited about?
I think the AI revolution is real. I mean, anybody who thinks that, like, there's a saying in imaging that an imager with AI will be better than an imager without AI, but that AI will not replace the imager. I don't know if that's entirely true, June. I mean, we're in the early innings of this game, and I think in the later innings of this game, to have an AI tool that is superhuman and can perform better than an individual reader, I think we're going to go to that. So I think it's going to radically change the field of imaging, but it's a tool, right? It's like logistic regression or multivariable logistic regression. That's a statistical tool. This is also a tool. Turns out it's really, really good, and it's going to fundamentally change the entire industry, but it is just a tool. So what we always focus on is, what is the human use case? Like, what is the clinical use case that actually helps people? And then we don't have to lose sight of it. We just use the AI as tools. So I know that there's a number of companies that are trying to figure out, where does this generative AI come into play, and how can we integrate that into our product portfolio? We have some ideas around that. But I think more than that, what we want to do is expand the clinical use case. And so, to an directly answer your question about what am I most excited about, we're just about to embark on a study that I think will be a landmark clinical trial to really test a hypothesis that we've been potentially doing it all wrong, doing it backwards, where we've been so focused on symptoms that we forgot about the disease. And if we focus instead on the disease, and given that it's asymptomatic in most individuals, I think we can do a lot better for humans if we start to be more precise in our evaluation of patients, not wait till they come in with end-stage disease and chest pain and shortness of breath, but get them much earlier in the cascade of their life. And so I think that's the thing I'm most excited about. This will truly be a landmark study.
That sounds like an interesting study. So we've discussed the importance of generating scientific evidence. So let's discuss how to commercialize these discoveries. Unlike traditional med tech companies, Clearly has set up value-based contracts. Why did you guys pursue this strategy? What should other med tech companies consider as they determine their commercial strategy?
Yeah, it's a great question. Like, it's probably the most important question for company survival. I think that oftentimes companies, including our own, in the first couple of years, you're just so enamored with the product that you actually forget that somebody actually has to pay for the product in order for the business to survive. There, like, as you pointed out, we have a heavy slant that value-based care, I think they got it right. Because if you look back in history, when, we went for the traditional fee-for-service that rewarded more volume, more payment, people wanted to do more volume. And so they did a lot of volume. Then you went to this sort of HMO models where it was just, we're going to cut costs. And now I think the current construct of value-based care, as we see it, tries to marry the two, where you can do volume provided that it provides value. And the value means that we should ultimately reduce the cost, but we should improve the outcomes of patients. That, I think, is philosophically the right way to go about it. And it's growing like a weed, right? Like in Medicare Advantage, which is a value-based healthcare delivery model. I think somewhere around 40% of Medicare right now is Medicare Advantage, and it's growing at somewhere around an 8% compounded annual growth, so that by 2050, almost every Medicare beneficiary will be in a value-based program. It's a good goal for us to have, but then the payment model is totally different in that there you have to deliver good care at a lower price. I think that's where we fit actually very, very well, because we can cut a lot of the extraneous waste out of evaluations if we can support doctors with our technology. And I think that's definitely a focus. In order to go there is some intrinsic link with traditional fee-for-service models, where you still have to have coverage and reimbursement in order to service a value-based play. So I think going after those reimbursements and the coverage policies through Medicare and commercial payers is also very important. And then the way you do that is, again, through scientific evidence, right? So I think this whole notion of having science be part of your DNA is going to drive not only fee-for-service models, but also value-based care models. And then what I would say, like, because you had asked me, like, advice to other AI companies is think about who's your customer, right? And why they would pay, because there has to be a value proposition, otherwise they won't. And that value proposition, I think, needs to almost intrinsically be twofold. There has to be a cost savings, and there has to be an improvement in health outcomes, and probably in the reverse order. But if you can't figure out, hey, my technology, it increases costs and worsens care, then obviously nobody's going to buy that. If it improves care, but at a ridiculously higher cost, then probably got to figure out a different commercial model. But it's definitely a multi-step play. But I think those are probably the two factors to consider is like, how do I help people and how do I do it at a reasonable cost?
And what does a value-based contract for medical devices look like?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a number of different ways you can approach it and a number of different ways that we've discussed with partners. But I mean, you could do traditional fee for service, right? I do a service, you pay me a fee. I do another service, you pay me another fee. That's not really a value-based play. You could do like what a lot of the sort of VBC stuff does with self-insured employers and go, we're just going to charge you per member per month. You could do, hey, you know what? We're not going to take any money upfront, but like we want to split some of the savings. So once we prove that we've actually done good for the system, and then the shared savings can be upside, downside. Like, so there's so many ways you can play this out. And I think what we do is just try to be malleable. And so, if a partner wants to do it a certain way, we don't care because I think that we do deliver better care for patients at lower cost. And so shared savings, PMPM, fee for service doesn't really matter. Like either way, like I think we can deliver that value. But I think that's not common, you're right, for med tech. I think med tech is typically just fee for service and it's hard to plug yourself into a value-based care play. But I think med tech companies should think about it because, we're going towards an era where the dominant payment classifications and payment systems are going to be value-based. And so if you don't think about that, then whatever your commercial models are, they're going to get obsolesced pretty soon.
Well, I think that's all we have the time for today. Jim, thank you so much for sharing the Clearly story. One final question before we go. What's your parting advice for aspiring entrepreneurs in the life sciences space?
Challenge dogma, because when I look back at my training in cardiology as a cardiology fellow 20 years ago, most of what I was taught was wrong. And we've learned more. And it wasn't a fault of anybody. That's the information that we had. And over the last 20 years, we've learned so much more about the field of cardiovascular medicine. And we were constantly asking, is this really right? Is this really right? Is this really right? And by doing so, I think then you get to that whole truth-seeking thing where you understand truth better, and then you can take care of patients.
That's really great advice to end on. Thank you again, Jim, for sharing your wisdom with me and our listeners. Hope everyone has enjoyed this insightful conversation with Dr. James Min, founder and CEO of Clearly Health.